Radio.
The same-sex marriage debate is currently a hot topic in Australian politics, with bills on the issue being introduced at a state level after the defeat of similar legislation at a federal level last year. With the backdrop of a draft same-sex marriage bill being published recently in the state of New South Wales, we spoke to Labor Upper House member Greg Donnelly on the current developments and the marriage debate in general. I'm joined here by Greg Donnelly, a member of the Legislative Council in the Parliament of New South Wales, and he's here to talk to me about same-sex marriage or the legalisation of same-sex marriage in New South Wales. Now, I just wanted to start out by giving a bit of background. About 2 weeks ago, there was a draft bill put out concerning the legalisation of same-sex marriage called the State Marriage Equality Act of 2013. And its long title is An Act to Provide for Marriage Equality by Allowing for Same-Sex Marriage Between Two Adults Regardless of Their Sex. So just in response to that, just looking to that, I just want to ask you a few questions.
Certainly, yeah.
As a member of Parliament.
Yeah.
So what exactly is this bill and what does it seek to introduce into New South Wales law?
It's a very good question, Luke, because it's a controversial bill that's actually attracting a lot of discussion inside the Parliament and outside of the Parliament as people become aware that there's actually a bill being considered in the New South Wales Parliament on the issue of same-sex marriage. Could just briefly explain a bit of context to this so the listeners understand, and I'm sure they know probably most of this, but just so we're clear. In the Commonwealth Parliament last year, there was an extensive debate over the question of whether or not the Marriage Act, which is the primary piece of federal legislation that deals with marriage, should be amended by the Parliament to provide for same-sex couples to marry, namely two males, gays, or two females, lesbians, to be able to marry. Obviously, in addition to what's provided for at the moment, that is a male and a female. That debate played itself out. In fact, it worked itself up to a debate over a course of many, many months, but ultimately was had in the House of Representatives. And the proposal was defeated. And it actually was overwhelmingly defeated by the Parliament. Now, the people or the proponents of same-sex marriage, which might I say is a pretty broad group. It's not people who are just same-sex in terms of their sexual orientation. There are a number of heterosexual people and single people who take the view that, you know, people should be able to marry whoever they like. That they thought to themselves, well, what next? We've been defeated, obviously, in the Commonwealth Parliament. And, of course, in reflecting on what's happened in countries and jurisdictions overseas, the decision was taken that we should try and see if we can get up in one of the state or the territory legislatures a piece of legislation to recognise same-sex marriage. So that's what they have now commenced. And your listeners may be aware that, in fact, late last year, there was an attempt to put through the Tasmanian Parliament a same-sex marriage bill, which, might I say, was ultimately defeated. It passed through the lower house, the Legislative Assembly, but was defeated in the upper house, the Legislative Council, by just two votes. But in politics, a vote's a vote, a win's a win, and it was defeated. Obviously, the decision was taken. Well, where to now? We've had this defeat in Tasmania. What might be another state jurisdiction where we can put in a bill and have it argued and see what happens? I'm not privy to actually the decision-making process, might I say, but I'm sort of reading between the lines here because that's all one can do to sort of observe what they're doing and draw conclusions. But obviously, a decision was taken. We'll try the New South Wales Parliament, even though there was a defeat in the Tasmanian Parliament. So, late last year, in November, what's called a working group of politicians in the New South Wales Parliament, and there's a total of five of them. There's a Liberal Party member, a Labor Party member, a National Party member, And there's a member of the Greens, and there's an independent member. So a total of five individuals, both in the upper house and the lower house, there's three in the upper house and two in the lower house, came together and produced a bill, which a notice of motion has been given in the upper house for a debate. Now, that sounds a bit technical, but what it simply means is that they've given notice that they wish to have a debate on a bill in the upper house. From a tactical point of view, I think what they've concluded is that they might have a better chance of getting the bill through the upper house and the lower house, so let's try it there first. So they've given notice. And what's happened, though, is that arising from the giving of the notice, and I know this is a very long-winded explanation, but it does give the full context. The Premier of New South Wales, Barry O'Farrell, said, well, listen, there probably should be an examination of this issue in some detail. So he's actually requested that one of the upper house committees, what's called the New South Wales Standing Committee on Social Justice, the Legislative Council Standing Committee on Social Justice, has been given a term of reference to examine the issue of same-sex marriage law in New South Wales. And that committee has commenced its deliberations, and that committee has received a submission from the members of Parliament proposing the legislative change or legislation, and we now have a copy of the bill. So we now have in the public domain a bill, which I might say is a draft bill. So the proponents aren't saying this is their final bill, but this is what they believe they want to put before the Parliament to debate. So the inquiry is underway. What will happen is the inquiry will run its course, and then once that's been done, it'll hand down a report, as it does with these things. And sometime later this year, there'll be a debate in the Legislative Council on a bill, which is either going to be the one that they've submitted to the inquiry, or they'll probably tweak it a little bit, and probably not too much, and there'll be a debate around that bill. And just sort of for completeness, if the bill gets defeated in the Legislative Council, you know, that's the end of it, at least for the time being in New South Wales. But if it passes the Legislative Council, it would then go down to the Legislative Assembly and would have to pass the Legislative Assembly and then come back to the Legislative Council. And then, if that was the case, it would be passed by the Parliament. But of course, as I'm sure we'll speak about shortly, there are a number of legal issues about whether such a law, in other words, an act by a state parliament to provide for marriage, actually can stand against what would be likely to be a constitutional challenge.
Okay, so what exactly is it changing within New South Wales law? Is there currently any marriage legislation that it's seeking to change, or is it simply seeking to introduce a law about marriage within New South Wales, a jurisdiction where no laws on marriage really exist?
Comment you made there is the correct one. There is no marriage law in New South Wales. The marriage law that operates in New South Wales is the Marriage Act, which is a Commonwealth piece of legislation. So if you get married in the state of New South Wales, as you do in other states and territories of the Commonwealth of Australia, you get married under the Commonwealth legislation. What this is doing is, and this is the proposition, is to create a piece of marriage law that operates only in New South Wales and in fact is a creature of the New South Wales Parliament. The New South Wales Parliament creates this law. I might say, and perhaps the listeners don't know this, that back in 2005, there was a piece of legislation went through the state parliament to provide for a register that now operates in this state, a register which is run by the Births, Deaths and Marriages Office, which enable a same-sex couple, if they wish to do so, to register their relationship with the Office of Birth, Deaths and Marriages in New South Wales. But we need to be clear that that is a relationship register. It is not marriage. And what we are confronting now, though, actually is a full debate about the issue of a piece of marriage legislation in New South Wales.
Okay. So as you mentioned before, that we've seen this go through at a federal level and it failed, and now it's appearing at a state level. Really, what difference does it make to the law where it appears?
Well, this is where we get into what is inevitably a technical legal debate and discussion, which is where this is actually all going to end up, because at the end of the day, there are some very clear and different positions about whether or not, legally speaking, a state parliament, and it happens to be New South Wales now, but it could be any state, can as a parliament legitimately produce a piece of legislation which seeks to provide for marriage. And the issue at heart is basically this, that when the founding fathers back in the 1890s in Australia and through the what were the sort of conferences that took place leading to the drafting of the National Constitution, Australian Constitution, they incorporated into the Constitution a specific power for the Commonwealth government to be able to legislate in a number of areas, including the area of marriage. In other words, the Commonwealth Parliament was given an express power to be able to, under the Constitution, legislate in the area of marriage. Now, the states also have legislative powers, and with respect to those legislative powers, they are very broad. But the issue becomes, if we have a situation whereby the states try to legislate in an area where the Commonwealth has powers, and you end up with either direct conflict or cutting across each other. Now, the people advocating the legislation believe the argument is, this is the argument that will win the day, is that the Commonwealth Parliament has ultimately produced an act called the Marriage Act. And the Marriage Act 1961 is the key piece of legislation in Australia which deals with marriage. And that Marriage Act contains within it a definition of what marriage is, which provides for marriage to be between a man and a woman, a male and a female. And obviously also, to be clear, it's got to be entered into voluntarily, obviously consent, with the intention of the parties that it be for life. So marriage, as traditionally understood, I might say, across cultures and down not just centuries, but millennia, okay? So our marriage legislation contains what is the traditionally understood definition of marriage. Now, the proponents are arguing that because the Commonwealth has legislated in this way, and it has an act which defines marriage in that particular way, it leaves it therefore to the states to be able to legitimately pass a law dealing with same-sex marriage, because if the Commonwealth, and this is the argument, if the Commonwealth has an act which provides for marriage between a male and a female, and it's not picking up this issue of same-sex marriage, the states can legitimately legislate in this area. Now, that though isn't the whole story, because that doesn't address this issue, and that is that there is this primary provision within the Constitution for the Commonwealth to legislate in this area and to what's called cover the field. In other words, the power was vested in the Commonwealth to legislate in the area of marriage, and that's marriage as marriage, not marriage as heterosexual marriage and homosexual marriage. There was never intention to sort of have different categories of types of marriage under the umbrella of marriage. So this is where the sort of conflict sort of emerges. The other thing that needs to be said within the debate, I think, that's taking place about the legalities is that states clearly could, for example, if they wanted to, legislate in other terms for a relationship. In other words, they could call it something else. But as soon as they pick up the word marriage in a piece of legislation, they are conflicting with this situation that the Commonwealth has, this legislative power. I mean, I'll give you this example. If they sought to, that is, the proponents of the change, sought for the state parliament to to legislate in the area of what are called a civil union, and we've seen these things being legislated in some places overseas, it's quite likely that the state parliament could legislate on a civil union and not have the same sort of legal argument about that as would be if they sort of use a specific language of marriage. There still might be, though, an argument on this issue if the civil union was designed in such a way to completely mimic marriage, which, as I said, is within the domain of the Commonwealth. So, I mean, the short story is that this is probably going to be ultimately, you know, determined by a higher court, and over time it may ultimately go to the highest court, the High Court of Australia, and I mean that's well down the path. But if we look to see what proponents have done overseas, that's what they've done. They've, even if they've had a loss, they'll ultimately take it to courts to see whether the courts come up with a different view. But I mean, where we are in New South Wales at the moment is that there is an inquiry coming from that. Will be a report, then there'll be a debate, and we'll see what comes out of it.
Mm. Do you think that the High Court is really the end game for legislation like this? Or do you think that if it passes at a Commonwealth level, that it wouldn't receive a High Court challenge?
Listen, my observation is that the people who are proposing the change are very, very determined to bring about an outcome that they see as favourable. They are very enthusiastic, they're very motivated, they're well resourced, and my view is that they're not going to give up. It is interesting if you actually look back at this debate in Australia, because it actually only a couple of years ago was being seen like this, that the people wanting formal recognition, homosexual couples, it was most likely that they would probably try and secure it through civil unions legislation. Now, they're called different things in different places, but I think back then, and I'm not exactly sure why this has changed, but back then, I think they, you know, were clearly aware of these constitutional legal arguments about marriage, and thought that what they would do is that they would circumvent all of that and go and pursue civil union style legislation. Now, I don't fully understand the reason why, but at a point, two or so years ago, maybe a little bit longer, they changed track. And I think as a group decided that we didn't want to have something that might be seen as second rate, as a registered relationship, and that really nothing will do but marriage. In other words, yes, we can get probably through Parliament's civil union type legislation, which wouldn't be subject to the sorts of legal debates and adjudications I've described. But clearly at some point a decision was taken that we'll no longer pursue this strategy, we'll go for marriage and marriage only. And perhaps that's on the back of successes overseas in some countries, and a sense of getting some wind in the sails and looking to see in some countries overseas where there has been success in this area, that if they've been able to do it, well, perhaps we should try and do it here in Australia. And the other thing too is that I think they do see, and this is, I think, as I understand their arguments, or part of their argument, that anything less than marriage really is differentiating them from heterosexual couples, which doesn't address their fundamental issue, and that is there should be no different or separate treatment. They should be treated precisely the same as heterosexual couples. And if you step away from that position, you don't resolve what is a fundamental grievance they have.
Mm. Well, I mean, as you're saying here, the change of tact really is also reflected in how this is becoming, I guess, termed a human rights issue. That term seems to be thrown around quite a lot these days with regards to different things. Because of that, there is, of course, as you mentioned, a large push and a large amount of passion behind this kind of legislation. You mentioned a little bit earlier about foreseeing legislation like this being pushed across Australia into the future. Do you think that it will be a kind of bombardment of legislation until this goes through? Or is there safeguards within Australian law or the way that Australian parliaments work to prevent this from being really, as I said, a bombardment constantly?
Listen, it's a very good question. And I think the short answer is that there will be just a continual and ongoing campaign until there is a breakthrough. And if I can go back to my earlier point, because the people who oppose the change, and I put myself into that category very squarely, is that we don't see this as an argument, in fact, over human rights as it's being portrayed, but rather a debate over changing the definition of marriage. And I guess that what I and others do is go back to first principles of what, mankind has understood marriage to be up until very recently, I might add. Now, it has to be acknowledged that in some countries overseas, parliaments or judge-made law, courts, have altered definitions of what marriage is. But what's being proposed, if you think about it, is quite radical, because the key elements of marriage, namely that it's entered into by consent, free consent, it involves two people, a man and a woman, obviously of opposite sex, and that it's entered into with the intention that it be a permanent relationship, has been well understood and well accepted and well supported by cultures and traditions of people of faith and people of no faith for a very, very long period of time. And you've got to ask yourself, if that has been the case, what have been the reasons behind the support for marriage in its traditional form as defined? And of course, that's when you start to look at, you know, what are the key elements of marriage as I've described, and of course, arising from the complementarity of the sexual partners, male and female, of course, is a production of children, and of course that we know that human children need parents to look after them. Over many, many years to nurture, to love, to care, to raise, to educate. And that obviously those children's interests are best served by that happening by their biological parents, their mother and their father. These things have not really up until recent time been really even questioned as being up for grabs, because it has such a normative, natural sense to it. That's the way that it is. But what we're facing now is a very sort of, you know, fundamental challenge to that, where the question of it is being removed from something that we take for granted and that we accept culturally. And as I said, this is not just seen through religious eyes. I mean, faith traditions, be they the Catholic Church or other Christian traditions, but you can look at Judaism and you can look at a range of other religions, but also people of no faith tradition have accepted this concept of marriage so defined. So this is a real affront of what's been in place for a long period of time. And of course, you know, the way in which it is being approached is to tackle it by saying, well, listen, as a person, I should have rights, and I should have rights across a number of domains, and that those rights are rights that should be shared by all. But as I said, the issue, though, is taking that argument and applying it to marriage and claiming that it's a human rights argument, when in fact, and this is my argument and the argument of the others, that really what you're actually endeavouring to do is to fundamentally deconstruct a very important social institution. Is that or is that not a good thing? Now, I might say that probably one of the biggest threats that has happened to marriage, you know, has happened, and in fact this has played itself out, I might say, over the last number of decades, was it started in the United States in the late 60s, but has sort of played itself out across the whole world since then. And in Australia in 1975, the introduction of no-fault divorce, which, if you think about it for a moment, amending the Marriage Act, which took place in Australia in 1975, allows a married couple, either one, to basically serve 12 months' notice on the other party, and that the marriage can be dissolved for no reason. Normally, what's put on the paperwork that's sort of processed through the family court is irreconcilable difference. Now, if you think of it for a moment, that was a radical change in our marriage legislation looking back. I mean, at the time, people were saying that was so, but other people said, well, listen, you know, this is just sort of dealing with an issue. People, you know, get married, things don't work out, they should be able to sort of be relinquished from their responsibilities, you know, pretty easily. But in doing that, it sort of removed one of those key cornerstones to marriage, and that is its permanence, because now, arising from that change back in 75 in Australia, it's not permanent at all. It's permanent subject to, of course, either party serving 12 months notice. So that was a major shock to the marriage institution back then. And if you sort of cast forward, what's happened over the years, and I think there are linkages in this, but others would sort of dispute it, is that because marriage now was fundamentally undermined by that legislation, we have now this almost unquestioned situation where de facto relationships really prevail in society, and that people cohabit, and in fact just not married, and indeed have children. I think I saw some figures just a couple of months ago where I think something like 80 to 85% of couples in Australia cohabit before they marry. And you've got to ask yourself, you know, why has that come about? And there's probably a range of reasons, but I've got no doubt that, you know, with marriage being something now which could be sort of exited with 12 months' notice, you know, men and women who come together and enter into a relationship ask themselves, well, why bother getting married? Because, you know, either can sort of exit with 12 months' notice. And, of course, what we have now, which is played out in Australia and other countries, is a situation where we have, you know, large numbers of children being born out of wedlock. They are born through relationships which are sort of de facto relationships or just cohabitations. And of course, the real tragedy to that is, and there is no question about this because the evidence is well and truly in, that cohabiting or de facto relationships are far more fragile than marriages. And that's notwithstanding the fact that marriages can be exited with 12 months' notice. But cohabiting and de facto relationships are entered and exited a lot more easily. And the effect of that is that, we have a large number of children born in these sorts of relationships now in Australia. And very tragically, a number of those relationships end over a period of time, and then obviously we have a situation where the child's being raised by one parent. And the truth of the matter is that one parent normally is the woman. And, you don't, I think, need to be a rocket scientist to work out that if you look at Australia, who a class of people doing it most difficult and are impoverished and do find it very, very tough, it's single women. Who find themselves without a partner, without a husband, boyfriend, whoever, trying to raise a child or children. And of course, we now have moved into this next phase of now further taking it to a point of saying, well, listen, we now are looking to sort of alter the nature of the genders in the marriage. So we've moved from being able to sort of break it with 12 months' notice. And now this issue then of being able to provide for alternate gender arrangements. So, people are saying, listen, it's something which we need to come to terms with, that that there is overwhelming support for it. But I might say that if you actually sit down with people and talk through it and spend a bit of time examining the issues, people, I found anyway, start to ponder over some of these issues and wonder whether it's such a good idea. I must say, in my view, it's very easy to get caught up in the attraction of a human rights argument and an emotion that goes with that argument. But if you step aside from that and you actually look at the issue of fundamentally changing a key human institution, and looking at what changes in the past have done and consequences and what changes, future changes might also provide for, I think people are a lot more sort of considered. And I might also say this, that if the law changes, it then becomes a question of the rights. For example, I'll just use this as an example, of parents in schools to have some determination over what is taught to their children over these issues. And I mean, I'll just use this argument because it's played out in the United States, in the states where they actually do have same-sex marriage, that, it's commonly taught now in the schools in the states that have same-sex marriage, and this is in primary schools, that a very natural, normal relationship is a same-sex relationship. It has complete equivalence to a heterosexual relationship, and that has to be accepted. That's the law of the state. Now, of course, that puts people in a very difficult situation. I mean, a number of people, once again, they might have a faith tradition or they may not, they just have a particular view, that a same-sex marriage or a same-sex relation is not equivalent to a heterosexual relationship. But in the United States, parents in schools that have sort of taken this to court to actually argue that they don't want their children taught about homosexual marriage or homosexual relationships have found that they've been, roundly defeated, because the courts simply say, well, it's the law that marriage provides for same-sex marriage, so it's quite appropriate to teach this in our schools. So that's in education, and one can go through other areas of how this will sort of, if passed through the parliament, will ultimately spread through and completely change the cultural norm about the nature of marriage.
Just moving, I guess, probably not to a more personal level, but a personal political level for you. Now, you're a Labour man, representative of the Australian Labour Party. There's been a little bit of confusion regarding the stances of the political parties since the ALP conference back in late 2011. Are you able to clarify what is the official ALP position on marriage? And are you, as a sitting member of the ALP, compelled to vote for same-sex marriage if it's to come through legislation in Parliament?
Listen, that was a very interesting time in the life of the ALP, and I was directly involved and in fact attended that national conference in 2011 where this issue was debated. The debate that took place then inside the Labor Party turned out to be a debate in two parts. It wasn't just simply a debate about whether the provision within the policy of the Labor Party should be changed to recognise same-sex marriage. It was that, but also whether or not members of the Labor Party could be required to support that position. In other words, like other matters in the past, like abortion and euthanasia, for example, whether members of the Labor Party would be able to have what's called a free vote or a conscience vote on those issues whenever they came up, wherever that might be. Whether you were at a local branch meeting as a Labor Party member talking about marriage, or whether you were the Prime Minister of Australia in the House of Representatives and everywhere in between. Now, at that Labor Party conference, despite opposing strongly the change of the definition, or that is the recognition of the definition of marriage from being only a man and a woman to two adults, the position that prevailed was that the ALP policy would be amended and has been amended to provide that marriage could be recognised between two adults now. So a very clear change from a recognition of marriage between a man and a woman to now two adults, which obviously encompasses same-sex relationships.
So just on that point, you've just said it's two adults. Does that open the door for a father and a daughter, maybe two adults? Does that open the door for that?
Listen, it's a very interesting point that you raise. I mean, if you actually look at the words, you could probably say it might open the door for that. It was not intended to open the door for that, and the background of that is very clear, that in Australia, under the Marriage Act, that Marriage Act contains a set of relationships, and it's called consanguinity, which prohibit marriage between certain people. And obviously mother and father, mother and son, or father and daughter fall into that category. So there are, that is essentially prescribed and prevented under the legislation. So no, that was never really in play at all, or not at all. It was to provide for the recognition of same-sex relationships. But the second part was this, and this was also achieved, and that is that in fact there would not be a requirement. There would not be a requirement for any Labor Party member, whoever they might be, to be bound by that position and have to support that position. So written into the policy of the ALP is a very clear set of words that in fact describe just that. That there'll be no binding of a Labor Party member on that issue. So, you know, you could say it's schizophrenic, and it is to a degree. The policy of the Labor Party in Australia now provides for a recognition of marriage to include same-sex marriage, and there is no question about that. But for people who are a Labor Party member, they can't be required to support that. Now, it should be made very clear that issue, that is this conscience issue, was opposed by a number of people at the conference, and it went to a vote, and that vote was ultimately a vote that upheld that right of a person to be able to exercise their conscience. But it is worth recognising that there was a large number of people at that conference did not want people to be able to exercise their conscience on this very important issue. And it does raise this question, and I've sort of discussed this with people before, that at the next national ALP conference, whenever that's held, and it won't be this year because there's a federal election, will there be a push by a group of people to try and remove that right of people like myself to have a free vote on this issue? Because we need to understand that last year, when this issue was defeated in the federal parliament in the House of Representatives, a number of Labor Party members joined Liberal Party members and National Party members to oppose the proposition in the House of Representatives. A number of Labor Party members share my view that they oppose same-sex marriage. But it will be interesting in a year or two's time to see whether or not the people who feel very strongly about this in the Labor Party will seek to try and remove that free vote that people like myself have. All I can say to that is that if they try that, there'll be a very big fight on their hands.
Where would that leave you, though, if that is to go through? Where does that leave you as a member of the Australian Labor Party?
Well, it'd leave me... I'm very clear in my mind about this, and that is that in good conscience, cannot and I will not support same-sex marriage, as I cannot and will not support euthanasia legislation, legislation that provides for abortion. But if they remove my conscience vote right, I would be put in the position where if a piece of legislation came to the parliament, I would have basically two options. I think only two. Well, there's three. One is I could support the legislation, which I wouldn't be prepared to do. One is that I sit out the whole thing. In other words, I get what's called a pair in the parliament and have myself removed from the what is ultimately the division and the vote. The third option is to what's called cross the floor, which means that I vote according to my conscience and I vote against Labor Party policy. Now, in the Labor Party, the effect of crossing the floor leads to your removal from the party. The Labor Party has a very long tradition, different from the Conservative parties, I might add, that when you become an elected member of Parliament, you pledge to support the Labor Party in the Parliament and you'll support the position and the policies of the Labor Party. If you cross the floor, you basically are contravening that pledge that you've made. That's why it is so, so important that there be conscience votes on these issues. And, I'm not saying that at the next national conference there will necessarily be an attempt to remove the conscience vote right. But I just make the point that when this was all debated back in 2011, there was at least a third of the conference prepared to deny people myself the right to have a conscience vote on this. So it's an issue that we might need to confront in the future.
Well, it looks like there's interesting times ahead. Well, that's all the questions I've got for you, Greg.
Thanks, Luke.
Thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
And I'll be certainly praying for this issue, and we'll be praying for it all here at Cradio. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Luke. Thank you.
For more interviews, talks and shows, visit cradio.org.au.